I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of a doctor in Congo who spent the past 15 years putting his people back together. Joe Lucy had planned to specialize in helping children with club feet, but when war spilled into his home in the early 90s, he knew he was needed elsewhere. He refuses treatment to no one. He'll stitch up soldiers from every side of the conflict. But his heart is with the women who are victims of sexual violence.
The people who are paying the highest price are the ladies. The sexual violence, it is so difficult to see all this that sooner or later people will all wake up like us. And we don't think it will continue.
Joe Lucy has become a specialist in repairing the physical damage. He says he can only hope for a time when people will heal from the emotional damage. I'll talk with Dr. Joe Lucy from his clinic in Goma, Congo. That's coming up right after the news. This is the story of a doctor in Congo who calls that country his home. For the past 15 years, Joe Lucy has been treating people, soldiers and civilians, who are torn up in the wars there. He says he often thinks about his own time growing up in Congo. His family lived near a game reserve. Back then, except for the wild animals in the jungle, it was peaceful.
The only problem was it was a reserve, so we had lions and leopards. So that was the only danger, the really danger than the animal. And things like hippopotamus were very dangerous for people. So the killing was from animals, not from people like today.
And every day when Dr. Joe Lucy treats another victim of a gunshot or the kind of sexual violence that soldiers inflict, he has no doubt that some of those men have become the wild animals they've replaced. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
The waves of war that have crashed over eastern Congo have caused the deaths of close to 5.5 million people. This includes all the people who've died from malaria and diarrhea and other diseases that could have been prevented if that part of Congo weren't under the control of warlords and soldiers and mercenaries from places like Rwanda and Uganda and Burundi and Congo. 5.5 million people. That's the worst death toll since the Second World War. In the middle of all this, we find Dr. Joe Lucy. He told me one story of trying to work in a hospital on the border with Rwanda and Congo. He was there and in the operating room when a rocket came through the roof, and then the soldiers came.
I was in the operating room, and then somebody sent a rocket on the operating room, and it landed on some patient and other people. So myself, I jumped into the sterilizing room. I was not hit, and then it was difficult because the Rwandan military were trying to come in and shoot a lot of people in, a lot of shooting. I tried to hide and to go upstairs, but I was too heavy. The guy wanted to pull me, dropped me, and I had to fall on the floor heavily like a bomb. And these people were so busy killing, shooting people, they just didn't even hear me falling. But I was there, almost crying on the floor. So I survived there. And it has been really a matter of life and death.
Were there friends of yours then who were killed in the hospital at that time?
Oh, yes. Not even friends. A lot of patients were. And there was corpse everywhere lying around. And in the morning, myself, I had to stay there at darkness. And we wake up, there was corpse everywhere. So it was really a big killing. You have never seen a war. But when the war, people with gun are shooting at the patient, everybody in the town. It is quite a horrific thing to see. And we were only happy that we were alive. But everybody thought I am dead because they didn't hear anything about me. So people knew that Joe is dead. Because my wife wasn't there, she heard the news that your husband is dead. So the proof was hearing my voice and hearing the rocket. So it was like, he's dead, finished. So some time later, we got a telephone. They knew that I was still alive. And actually, it was amazing to make sure that I am alive. It was a lady from America called Aman Power. Aman Power. She speaks a lot in CNN.
That lady from America Joe's talking about is CNN's chief international correspondent, Christiane Amanpour. She was also there and on the border reporting on the refugee crisis at that time.
Everyone who's old enough to walk does. Everyone has been walking for 3 days. For a child, it's like walking in the rainforest beneath the bobbing canopy of bundles and belongings. Some have name tags hanging from their necks in case they get lost. Others are tied on to their parents with rope.
So she, Herman Power was there to try to bring the breaking news. But then I told her, I said, oh, he said, are you Jewish? I said, yes. But they said, oh, so you are not there? I said, no, here I am. And so my wife understood through CNN that I was still not in the breaking news of death.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Dr. Joe Lucy has been close to what he calls the breaking news of death many times. In fact, when I talked with him, he was at his clinic in Goma, waiting for the chance to go back into the remote parts of the war zone. He'd been all set to go, but he was warned that some of the militia might be looking for him. You see, Dr. Joe treats anyone who's hurt, women, children, soldiers. He told me about one group of militiamen he treated.
They had just come from the war-torn place, and they were bleeding a lot. So we had to suture and try to recuperate them. And we still have the people of Rwanda and all the mixture of all the guerrillas. Four groups are fighting each other. So when there are victims, the UN people will just bring them and dump them to us, and they go.
Does this mean, Joe, that you get soldiers from both sides of the conflict?
Oh, yes. Actually, our strength is that any human who is shot, who has a problem, no matter which side you are on, we treat you equally like other people.
But this must cause some problems for you if you have been treating soldiers from one tribe or one group or one side and then the others find out that you're doing that. Don't you get yourself in trouble sometimes?
Yes, yes, but it has always been my trouble that there are four groups fighting, and if I treated one side, another group will just come and shoot at me. The groups are a little bit violent, so I will go in a different place where I will get all the people equally without much threat. So that is a serious question I have. When we go in a rural area especially, if you focus on one side, or one side is well treated, the other side dies, they will think you are associated to kill him.
It's still a pretty dangerous place for you to work, Joe.
Oh, yes. Every day. Even today, and even I am sitting here because I am afraid of being shot. And it is really, really terrible and difficult. I will fly only when they will tell me that the danger is over. I can operate without being threatened by guns. We still have the word, the guerrilla, functioning in the rural area.
I've heard, Joe, though, that you have become such a prominent person in eastern Congo, that you are so well known that there are some people, some guerrillas, who would like to attack you just because of who you are.
Exact. You are hitting exactly what why I didn't go, because the one who wanted to call all the people who are wounded or the handicapped put it on a radio message. And the people knew that Joe is coming. So all the guerrilla knew that they want to make news. And I was told not to try. And even this afternoon, they told me not to come yet because some three people came to the consultation with guns and so on. They were looking for somebody, so they didn't find maybe me. I was not there. If they kill somebody like me, then the government may accept to negotiate with them.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Dr. Joe Lucy says the worst of the war is not what he goes through and not the wounds of the soldiers. He says it's the sexual violence. Soldiers, he says, have made rape an almost routine part of their attack strategy. Dr. Joe says there are women he's seen, he's treated, women he'll never forget. One of them's a teenage girl, the daughter of a pastor.
And this, I mean, I will die remembering it in a really giving me pain inside me. It was this girl, she's with us now, I won't cite her name, because she's going to die this week or next week, maybe. She was raped, but the problem was, by punishing her, they removed her eyes, so she became blind. Not only that, they killed her dad and her mother, and she was a girl of like 14 or 13, so she became blind. Not only that, she got HIV because there were 5 military guerrillas. I think that the people who did horrible things in Rwanda, so they flew in the jungle where her dad was a pastor, into the bush. And she suffered that now because her family is all dead. We are keeping her in the hospital to say, okay, she must stay. We give her all the care we can. But HIV, it is terminal, and she is going to die. So this has been, for me, the most painful event. And it was why we all have said, if a man does this, we want him to get a maximum punishment.
You said this girl was how old?
She was 13 or 14. And today she has stayed with us like 1 or 2 years to try to make her survive. But she is blind. We have tried to give her a place to live and somebody to look after her and to dress her. But because of HIV now, she is terminally ill. We try to maintain her, but we know that they are numbered. Now she has a fever, everything. So we don't think we will see her in more than 1 or 2 weeks.
How did she get to you? How did you find her?
Because her dad was a pastor. So people of the church brought her to us and to say, oh, they can help her. And sometime when she was still good, I mean, the HIV was not very strong. We taught her how to sing, and she was singing to say, I forgive all the people who did this. She forgave them, and she began now to heal well because she forgave those who did that to her. But to say, the only experience she has in life was only that. It has been for us the most painful event.
What happened to her eyes, Joe?
They just removed them completely. It was just a knife. I think they put a knife and just wanted to kill her, but they ran away when people came to save her.
And does she speak?
Yes, yes. She used to speak very well and sing even to say she forgives them. But now she can't because, as I say, she's terminally ill.
Yeah.
But she's in our hospital. We all cry when we see her, but it is really a cross we have to carry with us.
Dr. Joe Lucy works in Goma in eastern Congo. He's the founder of an agency called Heal Africa. He also worked briefly as a politician in one of the Congolese transitional governments before returning to medicine. But he did one very important thing while he was in office. He helped pass a law giving new equality to women, making rape a crime equal to murder.
A lady is equal to men today in Congo. Before, if you raped a lady, no matter how much you wounded her, you were asked to pay only 1 chicken or 2 chicken and finished. But today, now it is a really maximal crime. So that means even killing a president is equal to raping a lady.
I'll talk more with Dr. Joe Lucy about that and about the people in Congo who inspire him in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. In Congo, there are people who hardly ever get to see a doctor. And that's not just hard for them, it's deadly. There are so many factions and soldiers in control of so many different parts of eastern Congo that millions of people die from simple diseases and injuries. The latest estimate is that close to 5.5 million people have died in eastern Congo just in the last 10 years. And that due to the direct and indirect effects of war. My guest is the Congolese doctor and orthopedic surgeon, Joe Lucy. If he had his way, he'd travel through Congo helping fix the club feet of children. It's his specialty. He still does that, but when he gets into remote areas, he usually finds people who've been waiting years to see a surgeon. One woman lived with a broken leg for 12 years.
I went to the rural area to Karawa, and I met a lady who had a small bone just outside her thigh. And when I just came there, I removed it so easily. And then the husband came jumping and saying, Joe, this is 12 years that I have slept near my wife without having this smelly. So that was 12 years before I saw. And in Karawa, they told me this. Joe, you are the first white man we have seen after 25 years. And I said, am I white? They said, but you work like white people. And I said, no, I am just, in America it's forbidden, but in Congo we can say I'm just black like you. Because all the missionary were gone or they were died or they were killed or eaten, I don't know what. But after 25 years, they saw the first white man in me.
Joe, how many operations will you do in one day when you're out traveling?
Today I have done 9, and when I am up traveling, I make assistant prepare like 2-3 beds, so we easily do 12 per day, so that means an hour operation every time. And it is because after all these years, I have acquired more experience in club feet than any living doctor. So we have really been doing a lot of this kind of operation. Club feet is a permanent malformation, congenital malformation. In 1,000 delivery of a black lady, there are 5 congenital malformation. In 1,000 of white delivery, there is 1.
Joe, what can you do for a young boy or a young girl who has a club foot? Can you make it so they will walk again?
Exactly. It is the easiest thing that a human can do, and you can do a perfect treatment. But it is, you don't even need surgery. You just do it manually. And if you teach the people how to do it, it's just a matter of 2 weeks, and the baby, the boy, will be exactly other like other babies. But in Congo here, they just say it is a curse. Your mother was cursed, or he met a special animal or a special witch. And because of that, they are afraid, they fight, they think it is something wrong. Then they neglect it. After 1 year, or 3 months, if it is not well treated, it becomes difficult and somebody will be handicapped for life unless you do operation. So this is why we are dealing with this, and to teach many young nurses how to do it conservatively themselves wherever they are in a rural area. And in a rural area in Congo, all our 80% of Congolese are living in a rural area.
I want to talk, Joe, a little bit about the work that you have done since war came to your part of Congo. I understand that you've been working under war zone conditions now for almost 15 years. How has that changed your work?
Oh, it has been a big maturing, because I have understood why God created me. You see, it was all the nation fighting without any help, and the people just becoming animal, killing one another. And then to see a whole nation left in the jungle without any help. And I have been struggling with them, to suffer with them, and to see them really almost dying without any help. So it have taught me to be just there to help them, to go with them. The way that I was in Nairobi, where I enjoyed the highest salary of my life. But then I left that salary to come and suffer with my people. But the people who are paying the highest price are the ladies. The sexual violence, the ladies are paying higher price than the soldiers.
Dr. Joe Lucy says he gets much of his inspiration from his commitment to Christianity. However, he admits that the way Congolese women suffer at the hands of men often challenges his notion of turning the other cheek.
This evening, I have seen a lady who, just before I came, I have amputated her finger, and the husband bite the finger of his wife, and he just eats and takes it with his teeth. And I just said, bring him to me, at least we can punch him a little bit, all of us. To say you take your wife and you bite a finger, and the finger had to amputate it. So I said, what kind of man is this? So when I see this myself, if I get that man, I will bite his finger so he can understand what it means. It is wrong, but we are human. Sometimes it makes us really, really cry tears when you see people coming to you like that.
I wonder, Joe, if you believe that the 15 years of war that people there have lived with and all the years that they've lived in refugee camps, is this making the people themselves increasingly unstable? Is this what's leading to that kind of behavior?
Yeah, it is really very, very unstable, because when you see the thing that people do, You American, you think it is just a given because you live in a very civilized country, everything is there. But when you live in the jungle, there is nobody, no road, nothing, no equipment. And then there was the war. We had what they call embargo. There was nobody to help our country because of the dictatorship. So we have been really, really left over in the jungle. It has been the jungle law. Violence, all those instinct, all those bad reaction with machete to cut people off.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Dr. Joe Lucy was telling me earlier how he and the other doctors and nurses become so deeply affected by the stories of women who are raped in war. He tells one story of one woman who inspired him to push for legal changes that may, one day, help them all.
This lady, having lost her husband, she ran into a village as exile. So five men came to rape her. When they brought her to us, we all cried, all of us. And this made us really say to mobilize all the doctors, everybody, so we must stop this. At least we are not this kind of animal. And all these ladies, they cried to say, why didn't they finish me up, to chop my head off? What they want is not to live like this. They want them to have killed them. No one can kill them now, but they said they should have killed us completely so we don't see this. But then this is why I was elected as a senator, and we stood, and I was so happy because when I presented, as I'm presenting to you now in the Senate, in the Palais du Peuple, People Palace, everybody cried and they joined me to say, Joe, we take a vow that this must be in our constitution. And it went. So I am so proud to say the biggest victory has been we have introduced this law in our constitution. It has been wholeheartedly voted by the whole nation that the most maximal crime you can commit in Congo is to rape a lady. It haven't been maybe implemented very well, but it is really in the constitution. And for me, it has been my biggest stamp in my life that I have at least achieved something for the whole ladies of Congo.
But tell me honestly, Joe, if you believe that something in the constitution or a law that is passed is going to make a difference to the kind of men who would gang rape women in the village. Do they care about that? It doesn't seem to me that they do.
Not now, but we call a parity. A lady is equal to men today in Congo. Before, if you raped a lady, no matter how much you wounded her, you were asked to pay only one chicken or two chicken and finished. But today, a lady is not worth a chicken or two chicken. Now it is a really maximal crime. So that means even killing a president is equal to raping a lady. It is so horrible because today we have like 100 ladies in Goma today waiting for surgery. And we are doing this surgery heavily every day. And we will be operating every day for 1 month. We will finish this 100 and something ladies of rape fistulas. And it is so difficult to see all this. To date, we have gone through 12,000 raped ladies, and we have operated on 1,700 to fix them up. So the thing is so horrible that we don't think it will continue. Sooner or later, people will all wake up like us. And even today, there is a lot of churches and organizations that are following our example to say we must stop this. And we are taking all the schools, primary schools, the military. So it is our job. We really think it is a big problem, must be tackled well. In Congo, it is a horrible thing.
Joe, you're Congolese. I can't imagine that you see all these women who are attacked in this way and you don't feel anger. There must be times when you become almost overwhelmed or want to think about taking revenge yourself.
Yes, I am really, I get angry. For example, one day, all the lady of the town came to me, say, Joe, stop, don't ever punish anybody who does rape. And all the lady heard that some military somewhere have done it, and they all came with a knife, and to say, Joe, let us ladies only punish him, and the men should allow them to do the judgment themselves. And they said their judgment was amputation of the penis. Then the men began all to protest, to say no. I say yes, if women were amputated, at least other men will know. But even Satan have never seen this kind of situation. So he said, let's not go that way. Let's stop things before we amaze even Satan himself.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. I'm talking with Dr. Joe Lucy in Goma, Eastern Congo. Joe married a woman from Britain. They have one daughter who works as a nurse. His son is serving with the British Army.
My son, Paluku, he's the only son I have, and he's now a captain in Iraq, in Basra. My son has really very, very strong conviction. What shocked him was he didn't agree with this Osama bin Laden thing. And for him, he wanted to say, I will show them that this is not right. Let's not accept that. And he really was shocked to see children and aeroplane going just to kill people. And my son saying, no, we must stop this. And he really believes strongly that Iraq have been well treated. But in America, you tend to think it is bad. But my son said, no, Iraq is a good country now. What it was, it is no longer that way.
I had read that your son was serving with the British Army in Iraq, and I puzzled about that because I thought to myself, here is the father who spends his entire life trying to help put people back together who are injured by war, and the son works as a soldier.
And he loves it, I don't know why, but it is because my wife's father was another military. And he used to drop the bombs on Germany during the Second World War. But you see, my daughter did some conflict resolution in the university. So I used to say that my daughter wanted to solve the conflict and my son is creating conflict. So it is a funny mixture of family.
I want to speak a little bit more about what's happening in Eastern Congo. Joe, I understand that there are some members of your own family who've been killed in this conflict.
Yes. It was my nephew. He went to go to his house. They were just shot him into the head, just here in Goma town during the war. And it was so horrible because his wife was in the hospital delivering their fourth baby. And so he died, just his wife delivered when we were burying the husband. There was no government, so anybody will shoot everybody, and we all have lost people. And not only that, when we have been losing people through the war, then HIV is taking others too. So every family has gone through the killing of the war, killing of HIV. So it has been really a year of a lot of horrors.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. I said earlier that Joe draws a lot of strength from his religion. He's deeply committed to Christianity. But he also told me that he gets inspired watching the courage of his compatriots. He told me about one young girl who's been with him for a long time. She helps out in the operating room.
She's a young girl, Sanga. Sanga means auntie. And she's not educated at all. But she helps us to dress all these people who operate. And now she has become the most inspirational person because whenever somebody cries, she cries with them. If somebody is dying, she will help the people to recuperate and to sit with them. And even if somebody is staying longer in the resuscitation, she will just forget to go home and stay there. So myself, I have seen the commitment of this person. She doesn't expect anything special. Whenever you need her, she is there. And even when we are away, we see her still cleaning the patient. She dresses them. And even if things are smelly, she just... So I say, how can somebody really love his work like her? This is Sanga. We call her Sanga. And I have paid a lot of money now to put her in the nursing school. I think the good should really bring the good. And she has been teaching me how to behave and how to love people, how to give people time.
And for all the violence that you see and all the victims that you treat, it sounds like this one young woman is in some way a reminder for you of that there is still humanity there.
Yes, and whenever I see her, because of her, I am now praying God every day to say, God, increase my faithfulness to be like this simple girl, Sangha.
Dr. Joe Lucy is a surgeon in Goma, Congo. He's the founder of an organization called Heal Africa, and we have a link to that on our website at thestory.org. I want to take a moment to tell you how it was I was able to speak to Dr. Lucy, because I think it's a part of the story. A reporter friend of mine, Michael Cavanaugh, was in Congo on assignment with the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. He told me about Dr. Lucy. He arranged a time when the two of us could talk. And Dr. Lucy spoke with me using a cell phone, while Michael sat beside him recording his answers with professional equipment. Then Michael sent us Dr. Lucy's answers via the internet, and the conversation was spliced together here. I'm telling you this in part because I'd like to thank Michael and the Pulitzer Center for their help, but also because I think it helps explain why stories from Congo are not heard more often. It's a place that's hard to get to. It's dangerous. And the stories, some of them, are hard to hear. But that's all the more reason why we need to work at it. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. We recently aired an interview with Luca Turin. Luca wrote a book called The Secret of Scent. He's a biophysicist who is captivated by the mechanics and the means by which we're able to smell something and how it is we can enjoy the scent of a well-made perfume. And Luca is uncommonly skilled at finding the words to describe that.
During one of my periodic visits to the Galerie Lafayette, I noticed a shiny black arch in the corner of the perfume floor. This was the brand new walk-in stand for a Japanese company I'd never heard of, called Shiseido. And it showcased their first Western fragrance, Nombre Noir. I still remember the black-clad sales attendant spraying it from a black glass octagonal sampler onto my hand. The fragrance itself was, and still is, a radical surprise. Perfume, like the timbre of a voice, can say something quite independent of the words actually spoken. What Nombre Noir said was flower. But the way it said it was an epiphany. The flower at the core of Nombre Noir was halfway between a rose and a violet, but without a trace of the sweetness of either. And it seemed to be glistening with a liquid freshness that made its deep colors glow like a stained glass window.
Kathy Vaughan heard Luca describing Nombre Noir and the other fragrances, and she wrote in to say, I so enjoyed the conversation with Luca Turin, I thought I would add one thing. I have a love-hate affair with perfume. My husband, who is an inorganic chemist, says I'm like a canary or bloodhound. My sense of smell is so rarefied and sensitive I can smell things that other humans can't. The perfume story that remains vividly with me, Kathy told me, is the winter night when I was 16. My mother and I bravely drove through a raging snowstorm in Baltimore to the theater to see the Royal Winnipeg Ballet.
It was a horrible snowstorm. My parents' house was out in the county. I just remember it was a terrible, I mean, it was the kind of snowstorm, it was like a whiteout condition.
And you and your mother are going?
I don't even know where she got the idea, because this was not something she would do. And we said, let's go. We got in the car, and we drove into Baltimore. This is a very old theater called the Lyric Theater. It's a very beautiful theater. And I can almost see it. We sat like midway up.
Was it crowded? Empty seats beside you?
No, and they actually thanked everybody for coming. You know, and I'm sitting there, and all of a sudden this smell, it's just this smell comes over.
A pleasant smell.
It's gorgeous. It's gorgeous. It was a perfume. I don't know if it was coming from stage. And I'm looking around. And I'm trying. I'm trying to locate where this is coming from.
If you had to describe the smell, how would you describe it?
It was... almost like a heavy, sensual, rich smell. It's really interesting. We've been making our own candles, so we've been buying oil. So I've been kind of trying to see if I can remember. There's one smell called bergamot. That I may have been in there. It was maybe a little musky, a little vanilla.
It was a feminine scent, though, that you were smelling?
If I could give it a date and describe it, and you would think of Paris, 1870. It was like red velvet. I can't explain. It becomes the whole experience. I don't even remember what they performed that night. This scent was so captivating. I mean, I was 16 years old. 16 years.
It is an impressionable age.
That's very impressionable.
And so how much detective work did you actually do, Kathy?
Well,
could you do to then hunt that scent down?
Always on my mind. It was always there. And it wasn't until years later, once I figured what I wanted to do, I became an illustrator. And I would go up to New York and I would go into now you had to be careful because those days you'd go into Bloomingdale's and they would attack you. But then I would go into some of the nicer shops and I remember walking by a counter just going, oh my, that's it. And I bought it.
And was it?
I don't know. I don't know.
But it was pretty close, wasn't it?
It was as close as you can get. It was beautiful.
And what was it? Was it a perfume?
It was a perfume. The company is called Jean Dupree, and it was called Bal de Versailles. And actually, I didn't like it in the perfume state.
Too concentrated?
No, it just more acidic. So I would buy it, need little bottles of bath oil, and just you dab it with like a Q-tip, and then just tiny.
So if you walked by me in the hallway wearing Bal de Versailles, would I sort of do one of these head turns and go, wow, what's that scent?
I don't think I'd wear it that loudly.
You're particular about not sort of cloaking yourself in this, right?
I'm not sure where I heard this, and I've just always kind of said this was true. A woman or a man puts on their perfume or their cologne. There's only two people that should be able to smell that. You and the person that's kissing you. That's it.
That's nice.
That's it. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think I find it really appalling that some of these people put on scents and they're just like wild.
What about Bal de Versailles? Is there still some in your cupboard?
No. And I've thought about actually getting some. You can't really find it in cosmetic places.
Someone will have it somewhere.
Well, you have to actually go online to find
it. But you don't do that anymore.
Well, I'm thinking about it.
So did you fall out of love with this scent? What happened?
No. What happened? When I ordered it, you could get the little bath oil, but it came with a large bottle. I guess it was the cologne. And I had it on the back of the toilet. And my husband hid it, and it went flying all over the bathroom. And I mean, I used... What didn't I use to clean that up? Alcohol...
You probably destroyed part of the inside of your nose, you know, finding something to overcome the smell of the perfume.
It was a memorable moment. I looked at him and said, how could you do this to me?
So let me ask you, if you close your eyes and think about that night at the ballet, those many years ago, can you actually recreate that smell? Can you bring it back?
Is it distinctive? Absolutely. I think, for me, an experience is... Totally, it's sight, sound, smell. It's everything.
But you forgot what you saw.
I can remember.
You remember that night by the smell, and it's a really interesting way to remember.
I can see one set of dancers doing something. But what comes back was just the overwhelming scent. And it would come in waves. But not, it didn't hit you like a truck. It just, it was beautiful. It was beautiful. I mean, if tomorrow someone said, this is what it was, I'd go, okay, I'm ready. I've always wondered, like, I always thought, maybe I should write, I don't even know if the Royal Winnipeg Ballet is still in existence.
Yes,
I'm
it
like,
is.
Is it really?
Oh, yeah,
really?
Absolutely.
And I'm wondering, I've been to Montreal. I've been to Quebec. And I'm thinking, there's no way to ever, it's all what is interpreted.
Kathy Vaughan lives here in Chapel Hill. You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Aaron Headley also listened to my interview with the writer and scent researcher Luca Turin. Aaron had read Luca's book, The Secret of Scent, and at the end of the book, Aaron got stuck on one passage where Luca described the smell of a discontinued fabric softener, one that Luca remembered quite fondly. It was called Sturgeen. In the book, Luca offers readers a reward if anyone can help him rediscover that smell. Aaron called me to find out if anyone had collected.
He mentioned some fabric softener from the 70s or something, early 80s, that he figures the scent was no longer legal in the EU, and so it had gone away, but it was so amazing that he would pay good money for a bottle of fabric softener. Just the idea that this guy had a memory of fabric softener from years ago and wanted to reacquaint himself.
And so you're curious to know if anyone had claimed the reward.
Yeah, I would have asked him.
Why don't you ask him now? He's on the phone.
Hi, Aaron.
Oh, it's nice to hear from you.
This is Luca. I was delighted to hear that you asked that question. And your timing is sensational because 3 weeks ago, I was given a box of a bath salts, a sort of a mixture of, I don't know what kind of salt, but then fragrance and color, and you pour it into your bathtub, and it makes the bathwater really cloudy and fragrant. Anyway, so I got this blue bath salts from the local shop, and I poured them into the bath, and out came the smell of Sturgeen that I hadn't smelled since 1971. So
Now, for those of us who are listening along, Sturgeen, what's that, Luca?
Sturgeen, this was the original fabric softener that I mentioned in my book, which smelled so sensational. And what on several occasions over the years I've tried to ask perfumers whether they knew who had done Sturgeen and whether I could get a hold of it. And they always look at me as if I've gone completely insane. But it just so happens, and that's why it's funny that Aaron should have asked that question, that literally 3 weeks ago I found it again in a completely different form, exactly the same smell. And now, you know, I used to soak my sweaters in the stuff, and now I'm the sweater. You know? I soak myself. So yeah, so good timing.
So despite the fact that you were ready to pay good money, the person who eventually solved this was you after all, Luca.
Well, it was complete accident. My wife just brought this thing back and said, look, you know, you should try this. This might be fun, you know. And to my real surprise, this thing was identical. I mean, it was so close that initially I just couldn't believe it. It's not that often that you find smells that come that close. So in answer to your question, I haven't found the original, but I found its reincarnation.
I have a question. Is it still being made?
Yes, absolutely. This is modern stuff. This is, in fact, their latest product. It's supposed to, like everything these days, it has an aromatherapy angle, which it wouldn't have had 10 years ago. But now everything's aromatherapy.
Nobody would have known what they were talking about.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, these days it always has some picture of a plant on the front, even though you suspect none of it's ever been near any plants.
So, Luca, I have a question. You have chemists that you work with in Paris and in London who,
Yes. You
told me, can pretty well imitate anything you give them. If you give them a bottle of this bath salts from Radox, will they be able to draw out of that exactly what it was that created the original Sturgeen?
Oh, yes. I would imagine this is fairly cheap perfumery. It's not fine fragrance. If you give that to a good functional perfumer, they probably write down the materials in it as a list in about 2 minutes, and then it's a question of playing with the proportions. But I would imagine it would be a day's work for them to give me a little jar of the stuff.
And Sturgeen would probably be happy to supply you with what they use.
In fact, as I say, when I asked, I think Sturgeen was made by the people in a firm that I actually have contacts with, and they really, you know, they would, I think they probably just erased the hard disk on which the recipe was contained. I don't think they have any trace of it. This is one of the peculiarities of the fragrance world, which is that it has very little memory of its own past. You know, you partly because things are secret and they sort of die with the people who do them and that kind of thing. You know, just to give you an idea, within a fragrance firm, perfumers cannot look at each other's recipes. They're not allowed to find out how the other guy did it.
You mean even the guy working at the next table?
Exactly.
I don't understand why.
Because it would discourage innovation in the sense that if you have someone who discovers some wonderful new trick, like a new melody, a new perfume tune, so to speak, if you handed out the how it's done, everybody would imitate them within days, you know, if it were great. And it's a form of copyright. But this internal secrecy is absolute.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. I caught up with Luca Turin in London, and Aaron, as it turns out, was on a trip to Ireland. Aaron had one more question for Luca.
Having worked with food people for a big chunk of my life, I know of people that are called super tasters.
Mm-hmm.
And I was curious if Dr. Turin was a super smeller.
No, absolutely not. I wish I were. I have a perfectly normal, average sense of smell. My only sort of consolation is that the average sense of smell is pretty good. You know, if you speak to a perfumer and they ask you to smell, you know, two different versions of something they're working on that differ in small details, most people would pick that up. You know, it's not that difficult. If you spend all day, every day, smelling different grades of lavender, after a couple of years, you become incredibly attuned to the minor differences that look very large to you. You know, I suppose the same is true for coffee tasters and you know, that kind of thing.
Now, Luca, you're working on a new book, a collection of recipes of perfume? What exactly is
it? No, not at all. This is basically a perfume guide. This is 1,500 reviews of fragrance, just as if they were works of art.
Now, are these all available, or are some of
obscure? Oh, yes. We didn't feel there was any point in being horribly frustrating by saying that some discontinued thing was, you know, the best perfume ever. That's just torture. That's sadistic.
Although that's a little bit what Secret of Scent does.
Well,
does,
yes. You know. I must say, I indulged myself there with some disappeared fragrances.
All right. Luca, thanks for your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And okay. Thanks, Aaron, for saying such nice
things
about
it.
And Aaron, thanks for your letter. Thanks for getting in touch with us.
Oh, no, it's my pleasure.
All right, enjoy your time in Ireland. Smell that Irish spring.
It's mostly manure.
Luca Turin joined me from his office in London. Aaron Headley was in his hotel room in Armagh, Ireland. Tomorrow on The Story, a rather unusual snapshot of the debate over immigration that's underway in Arizona. You see, business owners there are being told that they'll pay the price if they are caught with undocumented employees on the payroll. Harjit Sodhi is both a business owner and an immigrant from the Punjab. He runs a restaurant, and he's let a couple of his dishwashers go because they didn't have papers, but he doesn't want to lose his chef, a man who also happens to be undocumented, a man without a work permit.
Last 2 years, his work permit was not approved. Then the INS told him they not satisfy whatever document he summoned. His case was denied. First thing, he's my head chef. He worked for us 18 years. He know all the food cooking. And the point is this point. Somebody worked for me 18 years. He have wife. He have the house. He have one child. If I kick him out today, what his life will be, where he will be go if I fire him. This was not, if they want to make the law, they should be considered that kind of people first. Who was work for you 18 years and you fire him because the new law is? This took 4-5 years to get my chef here. If restaurant business can't survive 4-5 years, if you need the chef, you need week to 10 days or within a month, not 4-5 years.
Harjit Sodhi talks about changes in the immigration law and how it's causing changes in the lives of people. And there's an interesting twist to Harjit's story. He also went through quite a remarkable odyssey making his way into the United States some 20-odd years ago, entering illegally through a series of airports and walking across the desert from Mexico. He's also related to the man who was killed shortly after 9/11 in the first hate crime. And he'll talk about how all these different perspectives of his view of living as an immigrant in the United States bring him a different view on immigration laws that's being put together right now. If you have a suggestion of a story or a reaction to something that you're hearing here, I'd like to hear from you. You can go to our website. We're at thestory.org. Or you can call and leave me a message on our telephone line at 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.